Congratulations! You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast, with me, Kate Rhodes.
And me, Maysoon Wazwaz.
I want to let everyone know that I forgot to bring my regular glasses to this recording session, and I'm wearing sunglasses, and
inside.
I may alternate to no glasses. And so I just want people to understand that that is going to be floating and casting a pall over the entire recording.
Fortunately, I can see Kate's eyes if I squint.
Uh-huh. Is that enough. Really?
No, I can see them. Okay. I can see them through the glasses.
My face feels
you
naked.
You look kind of
without
naked without them
know,
on. It's a little bit awkward for me. It's okay.
I know.
I'll just look at your sunglasses. We'll
them.
Pretend like it's
I
daytime.
I should have drawn them on Bart. Maysoon, we got a secret missive from the Art Workers Anonymous.
They're anonymous, everyone. I don't even know who they are. I'm going to find out, though. I won't tell you. I just want to know for myself.
Anyhow, we keep our sources secret, as our journalistic ethics require. But the following recording, which you're about to hear, does corroborate a story I heard from someone I know who I'm sure was not who sent us this, but someone I know who works at YBCA. It's about YBCA people. It's about Tom Sachs, who basically told me this story also. So here it is.
Hello, congratulations, Pine Tree. This is Art Workers Anonymous. The Ego has landed. Our beloved Yerba Buena has opened its retrospective of the man-child, replete with pop culture references, questionable content regarding race and gender, and of course, the ramshackle space camp. Often we will give artists the benefit of the doubt when their attempts to address social issues that are not their crosses to bear don't quite pass the smell test, telling ourselves that perhaps there is an angle that we are not seeing and that their aim is truly righteous. Such is not the case here. Tom Sachs is an artist who claims he is not appropriating culture because he is elevating it. He is an artist who claims to take inspiration from only the best places, like in his words, Japan is the best of Asia. When a woman of color objected to his insistence that his white male American friend was better suited than an actual Japanese woman for public programming tied to his Japanese tea house installation, he complained to his staff loudly that she was a racist. He is not the first artist with an unbearable ego. He is not the first artist to center himself in discussions of other cultures. He is not the first artist to make misogynist art or scream at his staff. He is not the first artist with strong ties to questionable corporations. In many ways, he is the unfortunate standard in the backwards and dysfunctional art world. But what is unsettling is that the most visibly progressive art center in the Bay Area is dedicating immense resources to amplifying a voice that's fully loud enough. We encourage the community to go see the show and make up your own minds. There is certainly some interesting bricolage, and who doesn't like NASA? Also, Yerba Buena still deserves your patronage. They have several exciting shows coming up that will feature fantastic art by women and people of color. But let it be known, Sachs is cashing in on YBCA's reputation as a positive cultural force by peddling grade A whitewashing hidden behind a veneer of social awareness and his gargantuan head. AWA out.
What do you think of that, Maysoon?
Well, I have to admit I don't know that much about Tom Sachs as an artist, but I did go see the show today, actually during my lunch break, because I was like, let's go check it out. And it's definitely an incredible collection of, or I think incredible collection of like sculptural objects, sculptural objects. Visually, it's really interesting. It's kind of wild. I sort of have no,
So what is it? It's like space stuff?
It's all sort of space objects. You know, they're Mars rocks made out of, I think, wood and painted, you know, painted red. Or there's one like curiosity cabinet with like little plexiglass glass boxes that have what look like small rocks in them, but they're all ultimately like medication to cure any kind of ailment, basically.
Space and they have little ailments?
No, just regular headache, those kinds of things. It's real. It's interesting. It's an interesting show, but it also kind of left me feeling like I just am not sure what's going on here, which I'm okay with. Like, I don't necessarily need an answer right away. And I was telling a coworker that I expect to sort of wake up tomorrow and have like a very different take on it.
Oh, okay.
Just because
you got to let it ruminate for a bit.
Let it ruminate. Mm-hmm. But I did read a few things because I guess the most recent issue of SFAQ? Yeah, of the SFAQ newspaper, arts newspaper, there was a special edition on Tom Sachs. And so I read a few, I guess, letters in there that I presume he wrote. And there's definitely some pretty intensively offensive language.
Wow.
That I am like, is this a joke? Is he doing this to, I couldn't tell, like, was he joking?
What did he say?
I'll read it to you. I mean, just like stuff where I was like, I just don't think this is funny. If it is a joke, like, are you trying to get a rise out of us? And if so, where is that supposed to be going? Because I'm not sure if it's successful in that way. But in the same essay, there's also some interesting sort of like anti-consumerism rhetoric that I can kind of get behind.
Well, so it's a little bit like the usual like white liberal line where you're anti-capitalist, pro white supremacy.
Right, exactly. So it's definitely been like trying to, I read these essays before seeing the show.
I may have just called Tom Sachs a white supremacist.
I think that's okay. I think
want to walk that back slightly.
Let me read this to you.
Okay.
So the essay is called YT.
Why? In the question mark.
Question mark, yeah.
T as in the drink.
The beverage.
Right,
yeah,
got
the
it.
Usual
Thank
warm
you.
Beverage. There comes a time, and this is the very first paragraph. There comes a time in every Jewish, middle-aged, college-educated American man's life when he realizes that Japan is where it's at. Hold on. That's why, hold on, it gets better. That's why from Scarsdale to Sausalito, you see so many Zen gardens, koi ponds, and Asian second wives.
Yes, that he said that exact forum.
What did Michael Krasny say to that?
He was like, yup.
What?
he didn't give a shit. That's
God.
Why I hate Michael Krasny.
I find that so offensive. I don't know. It's so weird.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I like what the AWA secret robot man was saying about, you know, that YBCA has all these, you know, all this stuff up about, like, you know, Center for the Art of Making a Difference and all this stuff. And it's like, how did this guy squirm through the cracks?
I don't know.
The show is not probably awesome. Like, I've
the
heard great
The show is
things
definitely
from
interesting.
A lot of people about the show just formally and whatever. But come on.
Yeah.
Why?
Anyhow, so it was just interesting. I really want to try to solicit some listeners' feedback, some listeners to give us feedback.
Always.
I'm particularly interested in listeners who are fans of Tom Sachs and who either love or hate this work, but still, you know, I just want to hear another perspective because I feel like I've heard a lot of the
I mean, you
takes
saw
on him.
The show, like, if you hadn't read this interview and heard any other shit about it, do you think any of this, like, weird kind of, like, fetishistic, like Orientalism shit.
I feel like the tea ceremony with space would have been somewhat intriguing, or like, what is going on here? This is weird.
But you wouldn't
must
have been
be
like, oh, this
connection.
Is weird appropriation.
Not off the bat, because it didn't feel like it was that significant in the exhibition. No, there's so much more space stuff in the exhibition than there is Japanese tea ceremony stuff. Like, there is a small tea room, but from afar, it looks like just another space object, honestly. Like, unless you're up close and you see the tatami mats and,
right,
you know.
Yeah, it just sounds like if you don't have all this other information just from the work, it doesn't seem that wackadoo. I mean, especially
it is
like,
wackadoo, but in a way that's more like,
I mean,
what's going
like,
on here than like
problematic,
like, problematic wackadoo.
Appropriate.
Exactly. There is one really, really impressive console in not the big main gallery space, but in the smaller one that's like comprised of maybe 30 to 40 monitors that are all of, I think, I don't know if they're all active video cameras or some active, some less active video cameras that show you other parts of the, like people in the gallery looking at these different space or space objects. And it's just like the sheer mass of this and the construction of it is pretty incredible. Like it's that, that to me was maybe one of the highlights as far as sort of sculptural objects in the space go. Like more so than the actual spacecraft in the main space, I guess. It's interesting. I would love for you to go. I would love to chat with anyone about it. I probably will go back.
Call in, listener. I'm intrigued. 419-351-6606 or email us congratulationspinetree@gmail.com. I just want to know if listeners think we're like overly sensitive about this stuff and they're not on board and they think like, you know, whatever cultural appropriation is like way people are way overly sensitive about it or whatever. Or if they think that we're not blasting him hard enough.
Yeah. Margaret Tedesco. We want to hear
from
you.
Yeah, Margaret Tedesco.
You'll give us the real. You'll give us what you think.
She doesn't let any bullshit slide.
Nope. From anyone. It's perfect. Oh my God. It was like a real breath of fresh air to walk into Yerba Buena Center for the Arts after walking across the street for like 3 minutes, swarmed by Salesforce people.
Oh, Dreamforce.
I was like, get me in here immediately. It was fucking nuts. The whole outside of Yerba Buena Gardens is like swarming with people with blue fucking lanyards and this new backpack that they have.
So it was intense. For listeners that may not be familiar, there is a event happening in downtown San Francisco.
Do not drive into the city, people.
Called Dreamforce.
It's a conference like that Salesforce puts on every year.
Salesforce is like a software thing where you enter numbers into a lot of different squares.
You're basically a robot.
Yep. And they're also erecting what will soon be the tallest building on the West Coast in San Francisco.
You're right.
And which is a product of perhaps the largest economic boom of all time.
Really?
Bigger than the gold rush.
Hmm. Yeah.
I heard that.
Interesting.
From a meme.
Oh, I'm like, that's really like a...
Look into that. We'll look into that for next time.
I'm like, oh, we've never heard that before.
We don't look into things.
But we try our hardest not to.
Point is, Maysoon.
Steer clear.
Steer clear.
Blue lanyards. How long is that going everywhere. On? I think it's a full week.
Dear God.
Yeah, I was like, oh, right, I shouldn't go outside. I overheard someone in the elevator saying how it took them like 15 minutes to get a cup of coffee because there were just so many people in line from this. You'd think they've got free coffee in every, like
nook
all over
cranny.
The place, you know?
Free croissants.
There were special tents set up in Yerba Buena Gardens that were like specific to Salesforce people. Like they had signs and like a guard. So they were like these public but private, you know, out in the public but totally private enclosures. It's kind of gross.
Got a quick event we wanted to share. Friend of the show, Eric Parra.
Whoop whoop.
He's having a show.
He's
right.
A painter.
He sure is. He's a real painter's painter. And he's having a show right out here, right here in San Francisco.
At a gallery called State.
1295 Alabama. Another way to remember that is 1295 Alabama. And that's going to be up from October 15th through November 19th.
Yeah.
That's button right up almost to the
Heck
holidays.
Heck yeah.
And the opening will be October 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. Some other events coming up.
You know, I just got an email from the San Francisco Arts Commission, and there were a lot of opportunities that they listed, which I thought was pretty cool.
Let the people know.
This event is this Thursday, so you probably won't go, but I was curious and I will probably report back at some point on it. But there's a public meeting for the Treasure Island Public Art Program, which is, the meeting is basically for the public to give their input or their opinions on what Treasure Island wants or what should be on Treasure Island as far as a public art program, which I think is always a good thing to take advantage of if you can. That's Thursday from 1:30 to 3 at the Oasis Cafe on Treasure Island.
Oh.
Right. I'm like, that's cool.
That definitely privileges the people that are already there.
Yeah.
That's cool.
In the middle of the day. there's a conference called Every Day, Every Way, and that's on arts-focused youth programming.
Ooh.
Which sounded pretty cool. And that's October 13th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the African American Art and Culture Complex. And then there's also some nonprofit displacement mitigation grants. So if you're a nonprofit and your rent is going up or you're getting evicted, you can apply for financial assistance through the Arts Commission, which is fantastic. All this information is on their website. We can link to that. But those deadlines are due October 14th by 5 p.m. And this doesn't have anything to do with opportunities, but San Francisco Arts Commission Passport 2016 is going to be in Chinatown this year. And that's an arts event.
Where you go and everybody gives you a little stamp.
Yeah, you buy a passport. It's basically like a small moleskin. And they invite a handful, maybe like 15 to 20 artists to create, you know.
Cutie little stamps.
And then you go around and collect them all. And that's on the 23rd from 12 to 4.
Oakland Stock is also taking applications.
Oh.
For people, if you want to get a little bit of money for an art project or whatever you got going on, you go down there. People pay to get some soup, and then everybody who is made it to the final selection process.
Wait, can you just go back, pay to get some soup?
You pay to get some soup.
I don't understand.
The people sit and eat their soup, and they listen to the presentations of the people trying to get the money, and then the money they paid for the soup goes on to the person who wins the money.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I love that.
Oakland Stock. I think Lexa Walsh is the person to contact, but I'll have info in the underworld.
Cool. That's great. And then our good friends, Root Division, they're having their annual auction.
I got a piece in there.
Oh, do you?
Go buy it.
Go buy it. What is it?
Little painted portrait.
Is it little, a very little painty?
Small one, and the hanging system is earthquake proof.
Oh, perfect. Look at you thinking for your buyers.
Disaster.
Potential collectors.
Uh-huh.
That's on October 27th from 6 to 10.
Lots of other people besides me, if that's not the selling point you were looking for.
I thought it was just you. I thought you were the live and silent auction.
DeRosa is also having their auction later this month, and so is the San Jose Institute of Contemporary Art, and all their auction stuff is up now, so you can go check it out.
Cool. That's great.
Down there in San Jose.
San Jose. I know we've talked about this before, but I really, just really wanted to give a shout out to someone, to a friend of ours and listener of the show, Jennifer Wofford.
Yay!
Because I had a chance to go to visit her karaoke chapel.
You went to the big closing party,
and
huh?
It was fucking amazing.
This was the Prince show after Pop Life over there at Minnesota Street Project, curated by Glenn Helfand.
But
and their closing party was on Saturday.
But specifically, that chapel was incredible. Like, she just put so much work into it. I couldn't believe it.
It was amazing. Media space back there. The little video room had three projectors that projected on three walls. The karaoke.
Yeah, but she
lyrics
did,
plus also Wofford eyes.
Tons of drawings.
Karaoke videos,
I mean, she just did so much work.
Stained glass windows.
Yeah. Incredible.
Flying doves.
It was amazing. It was fucking amazing.
And
it was the best
karaoke
chapel I've ever been in. I didn't get to experience the fog, which was a little bit sad, but it was so much fun that I just didn't even remember there was fog.
Yay. Sophia Cordova and Matt Kirkland's band was also playing. They're called
Chucha Santa Maria.
And Bonanza had their fashion show and also made outfits for the
there
performers.
There were
and
hundreds of people, hundreds of models.
Hundreds?
I mean, it seemed like there had to have been at least 50 people in their clothing. Seriously. They, like, covered the stairs in Minnesota Street Projects. It was impressive.
Oh, yeah.
I got there kind of late, but it was pretty exciting.
We almost forgot. Kathy Aoki is having an opening at the Berkeley Art Center of a very intriguing show called Formidable Fragments Breaking Down the Culture of Cute. Now, I gotta tell you a little bit about this one, because... Congratulations Pine Tree kind of contributed to the show with a fake podcast about this Hello Kitty monument, and the show has all this stuff going on. It's like an alternate reality, okay? So the show's up from October 8th through November 20th, and the opening reception is this Saturday, October 8th, from 6 to 8 at the Berkeley Art Center. And Kathy will be doing a little presentation talk thingy on November 3rd at 6 p.m. It's going to be wild.
Rafel, I'm here with Mickey Murch, one part of the Gospel Flat Farm, and I would say the origin force behind the farm stand, a space that you may have heard of if you're in the Bay Area. I think by my count, probably about half the artists and musicians that I love on the West Coast have shown their work or otherwise perform in this space. So I guess it's safe to say at this point that a fair few people have gotten to check it out. I guess today we're going to talk a little bit about the origins of this space. So the first thing I'm going to ask Mickey here, I guess more generally, how did this happen? 10 years ago, I knew you in Portland, and I'm wondering what kind of art you were interested in making then. I'm just thinking right now, this moment of seeing this crazy communal meal, this mobile unit, and... I guess it seems like a natural growth, but I'm wondering, how do you get from these sculptures into this massive operation that we have here now?
Well, the sculptures were designed to take art in our familiar form. Art is hung on the wall. It's in a gallery. It's in a museum. And I wanted to take art and make it in a way unfamiliar from the square on the wall, but in a way make art more familiar. So there's things that we all have in common. We all eat food. We all share public space. So let's take those two ingredients, food and public space, and somehow put them together to make a positive message. So what that really looked like was taking a bunch of scrap metal, old bikes and cob materials, and put together an oven that could be wheeled around, and then find some scrap wood and gather together some ingredients and have a hearth in public space. So the old sculptures had fold-out tables and homemade ceramic utensils and wood bowls and basically homemade, artistically made utensils. And the whole kitchen was kind of fun and fantastic. But the real art was when people started participating. That the real art was teaching someone how to make bread dough and then getting their hands in the big bowl and get them to get all sticky with dough, and to get people to realize that cooking food is a great convivial thing to do. It's conviviality, is sharing this sustenance and having a great time while we do it. And so it's making conviviality in public and taking what normally is a process behind the kitchen doors that are closed and making it more fun and accessible. So we used to brew beer in public space. And of course, it'd be some partaking of the beer. And it's fun to learn how to preserve things and how to make something from scratch. And suddenly we realized that we don't really spend enough time hanging out and cooking food as a culture. And if we spend more time cooking and thinking about where our food comes from, we're going to be more healthy and we're going to have a great time together. And in the end, it's just fun. And so our farm really keeps that as a priority, that's we want to have fun growing food and making food for people to take it home and have fun with. So we try to be inspirational in that way, and feel like art is the whole process of growing food, and it's also what people do when they come home in their kitchen.
So I guess I'm thinking about this period around 2003 to 2006 or so in Portland. I remember watching, you know, I guess that sort of transition that happens. Maybe you go into making art and you think you're going to make stuff for a gallery. And I remember this moment thinking, well, we're not going to graduate if we make work for a gallery. Of course, we had Jerry Andrzejczyk advising us, and she may never have said it, but it was pretty clear she wasn't going to support us working for the man, or whatever you want to call it. So I'm thinking about two things. I'm thinking, well, you have this growth where you're doing something that at the time I didn't know the word for. I knew performance art, and I knew that sculpture could happen in these weird places, but suddenly there's these crazy social arrangements. I'm seeing people having dinner together in public space that would probably never otherwise talk to each other. And then I'm also noticing that you're working with, you start to work with your own farm, bringing canned food back. And around that time, I recall a lot of people were talking about organic food and the Iraq War. And I had not been privy to the 70s where people were thinking about organic food and, fertilizers and pesticides coming from the fossil fuel industry and all this stuff. But anyhow, the long story short is all that movement ended up seeming, I guess, pretty romantic to some people, but it almost seemed like you were going this opposite way. And I wonder what you think about organic food, organic farming, and then what you do then and what you do now. It seems accessible and it doesn't seem entirely romantic.
Yeah, I don't think of organic farming as being romantic. I think of it as very simple in that all I need to add, my input in my system is manure. That's all I have to add. And if I just keep my soil really fertile and really healthy, and I'm smart about rotating the various crops that I have, so if I have 30 different crops that I'm growing, then it's easy for me to rotate where the different crops are, and that takes care of pests and a lot of plant disease. And so if I just add enough manure in the beginning of the season, then I have great crops. So it's not romantic, it's just simple. It would be way more complicated to be a conventional farmer and then have to spray things. I don't even have a sprayer. I just have a manure spreader. So it just seems like in my life, I've realized the more simple you get, the better off you are. And organic farming is very simple. If you just follow a few ideas and concepts, and they're all biological ideas, that's very simple. And our farm stand is very simple as well. There's basically no moving parts. There's just people coming to buy the produce, and there's a cash box.
10 years ago, 15 years ago, whatever, this work you're making, performance stuff, sculpture stuff, and then now there's this massive honor system farm stand. It totally, people love it. It's operating all the time. The space is host to countless artists and musicians all the time. The traffic is constant. There's always people visiting the space. I guess it looks like magic to a lot of people that see it, but of course, I remember, yeah, things in Portland that are far more humble, and it just seems like this incredible growth, but I guess at the time, there wasn't a name for all this stuff. I guess to me, it seems sort of incredible. How did you sort of decide to go for it? I mean, other than the fact that the farm's here, and you can grow food, and you know how to make, you eventually figured out how to make the thing sustainable, I guess it's sort of like there wasn't this word social practice, at least in my little bubble 15 years ago. I wasn't hearing it. But now I guess some people would say this all fits into that sort of genre, that sort of experiment. But yeah, I'm just thinking 10 years ago, there are these crazy mobile sculptures. You're looking at performance. What are you looking at? Like what are the seeds that sort of lead to all this?
Well, it's very inspiring to make an installation out of all of your produce. That's, once you really get into it, you know, all of the bunches and all of the ingredients that go into the farm stand, they're all this meticulously made art. You know, the putting together of all this food in one space it's beautiful. If you were to transfer that to a gallery, people would say, wow, that's so amazing. And then if you suddenly said in the gallery, you guys can buy this produce and take it home. And then it suddenly it would be interactive art. And so, you know, if you were to isolate parts of our farm and put it in a sort of this is art atmosphere, it would be incredible. And part of the inspiration is just saying, okay, we don't need to put it in an art space. We're just making social sculpture and it's here for everybody. And people don't need to think of it as art. I don't care whether someone sees what I do as art. But when I'm growing produce, I'm using my sculptures that I've welded, and some of them are tractor implements. And so there's this whole process of growing the produce that took a lot of ingenuity. And so it's kind of like an artist making their paintbrush out of a special kind of fur. You know, I'm making my plow out of different ingredients of metal and scraps and trying to come up with different ways to engineer myself out of backbreaking work. And so there's the whole process behind growing the produce that became part of the performance and part of the creating the artwork is starting from how we actually plant. So I'm inspired from the actual process of how to grow produce, and then it's inspiring to put it all together and see what kind of beautiful display we can make 365 days out of the year. And then there's another added inspiration when I just hear people come to the farm stand and they're having a conversation about, oh, have you tried these poblano peppers? Oh, let's make a salad out of this. Oh, look at these onions. And that's super inspiring to just hear that conversation and think, my art is just an ingredient in someone else's art. And when someone takes that food home, they're going to make art. And they're going to have a social experience doing that. And in the end, I don't have to be an artist that's selling art in a gallery and trying to really move my work. I'm selling my art $2 at a time. I mean, it takes a lot of bunches and a lot of pounds of produce to make a farm run. And I'm selling my art, you know, a few cents, a few dollars at a time, and I'm happy to do that. I'd much rather have art just sort of slowly accumulate into an economy than have to worry about making the next sale of art that was going in the gallery.
I have just one last thing I want to make sure we get in, because I think it's just fantastic. I guess I've heard from Don, your dad, Gospel Flat Farm, I guess, got its start in the 80s. Is that right?
1980.
And he got this place, and if I understand, I remember farming in 2004 and finding pieces of cars coming up through the soil. What the heck was this place in 1979, 1980?
Well, it was pretty dilapidated. There's a great old pictures. And then on top of that, in the early 80s, there was tremendous flooding. So around the time I was born, my dad was scooping mud out of underneath the house and all the driveway, and it just had completely flooded through our property and had been the dumping ground of, you know, in probably 1950s of all of this junk metal, basically. And so it was a major cleanup to get this farm where it is today, and we still have more cleanup to do. But it feels good to farm in a place where someone who had seen it in the 80s would look at what we have now and say, wow, you guys have done a lot of work. We have seriously fixed up this place, and the fields are more fertile than ever and more productive. And I've really done a lot of bushwhacking because all of that dirt is so precious. So now we've, you know, sort of beat back the willows, which is kind of a creeping tree, and we're farming pretty much all the land we can. And it's beautiful to see a piece of land that was basically where the bulldozer had pushed the junk to side, and then finally get in there, clear out those bushes, pick through all of the ancient debris, and mostly just chunks of concrete and old culverts. And yes, there's the occasional car part, and that I hit with my big ripping plow. And we just throw it in the junk pile and have a giant mound of old farm junk that is precious in its own way. But we're cleaning this place up, And my dad did an incredible amount of work to get the farm where it is now. And the old farmhouse is seismically pretty stable now. And so it feels good to have four generations on our farm. And we're all so proud of it. And I think the farm stand, it really keeps up that inspiration that we're not just an isolated farm and, you know, good for us, but what when we have a success, it's translate directly to food for the community. And so I really feel like I'm proud of what we do on this farm, and I'm glad that we found a way to fit into a community that's also happy that we're around. And
yeah. As you're talking, I'm just having this memory. I'm trying not to laugh. In between you doing this social sculpture, whatever it was called, and the performance in Portland and the farm stand today, I just remembered that in the clearing up of the farm debris and, you know, rehabilitating this land, you discovered a World War II lifeboat. And I'm just thinking about how beautiful that is, because that thing was disappeared behind debris and behind bushes, and that thing became a mobile school. And now, if I have my dates right, 2007, that thing grew a roof, it grew multiple stoves, two sinks, huge cutting boards, and I know that I helped teach classes on canic food, making cheese, and all of that was back when, I guess, your operation was mobile.
Yeah. So, just to go back over that, it's true, there was a life, and well, I didn't know what it was. It was just a big piece of metal, a metal boat that was back in the bushes when I was a kid. And it was always a little too deep in the stinging nettles to actually go play in, but I knew it was there. And when I came back to the farm and I had my mobile kitchens, those mobile kitchens didn't have a roof. And it was winter, and I was thinking it would be really nice to have a hearth that had a roof over it. So what kind of trailers could I find on the property? What kind of scrap metal could I come together? And I thought, whoa, what about that boat? So busted out the chainsaw and cut out the willows that were basically growing through the rusted bottom of the boat and popped it out of this flood silt that had completely surrounded it. And it was then we realized, because a friend of ours used to have a World War II lifeboat as a houseboat in Sausalito. So she recognized immediately that this was one of the lifeboats that a lot of the hippies after, you know, in the 60s and so in Sausalito had these boats as houseboats. And so it's identified as a lifeboat. And I just love that metaphor, because my whole plan all along was to make a kitchen that had the fermenting things in it, and it had the canned goods, and it had the chickens roaming around underneath it. So all of these ingredients of the meal were growing around. So it's kind of a farm kitchen that would be loaded up with produce, and then it would be mobile, of course. So they found this, my dad's old steel trailer, and then hooked the tractor to the boat, which was all welded onto the trailer with a big crazy roof, and we would haul our produce into Bolinas. And this was the same year that we realized that the farm stand was the way to sell produce, but we were doing these weekend school markets, and yeah, teaching kids, and also kids would come. There's an after school program. Kids would come to the farm, and we would go around the fields and collect up things to make stuffed squash blossoms or whatever, good teaching kids how to cook greens. And we would go harvest, collect some eggs, you know, whatever it was, and all the kids would come back to the kitchen and we'd make an afternoon snack. Then their parents would come collect them. And so it was a functioning school, and that was mostly before the years that I had my own kids. Who I prioritize.
I'm just remembering too that that lifeboat also became the centerpiece for a lot of video work, and I've seen bands play in there late at night. And I guess now that I think about it, the farm stand now, it's a heck of a lot bigger, but in a way maybe that's just an organic growth too.
Yeah, I think you're right that we sort of haven't moved the lifeboat into the community space, into public space, for a while, because we have this amazing farm stand and the community comes to the farm. So why go through all the trouble of moving something when the moving parts are all of you people out there and you're welcome to come by the farm. And the lifeboat is still there. It's our sort of farm worker kitchen, and it's still there 10 years later, and it's not rusted. So it's a success. That was a sculpture that is still useful, and it was so inspirational that it really fed into the farm stand. And you know, that launching our farm through this lifeboat into, you know, when I say launch, I'm thinking of the term of actually launching a boat into the water, but to launch the boat off the farm is kind of a similar metaphor, and bumping it down the road into Bolinas Town. By the beach there, we would sell our bread that we had baked and produce. That was in order to really break down the barriers that were surrounding our farm. We had this sort of insulated farm, and we really wanted to do a lot of outreach. And that's how we got a lot of word out that we were growing produce for direct consumption to the public. And that was really what launched into the farm stand. And we always want whatever simple is best. So people coming to the farm stand is a lot better than taking the produce to the people.
Awesome, man. Well, I think that just about covers it. Thank you. Congratulations, Pine Tree, for giving us the chance to tell this little story.
We're going to be doing a recording of the show at the Headlands Open House on October 16th. So please come by and you can come and chit chat with us. We'll have extra microphones set up. We're going to be doing our whole deal, probably talking some shit about the Headlands.
We're going to be talking to some artists.
All right. So come on out to the Headlands. I hope you have a car or a friend that has a car.
Oh, we should let you know that we will be doing our election coverage
next week.
Not election coverage, but election ballot
preparation. We're going to be giving you our Congratulations Pine Tree trademark voter guide.
Yes.
For San Francisco and Oakland and some of the Alameda County / whatever county you're in.
Yeah, San Francisco. I'm in San Francisco.
We'll set you all up. Mm-hmm. And we're doing it early this year in the hopes that it'll, you know, absorb.
You'll have some time to listen and to re-listen.
Yes.
And to be reminded of certain things. And, you know, if we have time, maybe we'll even do like a quick...
Just a quick summary, like before Election Day.
We yeah,
could do just do a like quick yes, summary. No, yes, yes, no.
Right, we'll do like a quick PDF.
Just
like,
and I just want to say right now that Darlene, I want to say Jones, for the new AC Transit chief of staff or whatever the head of AC Transit is over there in Alameda County, people, and she needs to run AC Transit. I am just so regretful that I didn't campaign harder for her last time, because she was up for it last time too. She was a bus operator for 21 years and we needed to elect her. I should have campaigned harder for her last time, and it's led to my own very personal struggle with public transit, including the number 6 bus, the 57 bus, and even the 11 bus, which you think the 11, that's always on time, but you'd be wrong. So we got to fix this, and that responsibility falls on us, the voters.
Yes. And that's a responsibility we should
take
be
seriously.
Happy to have and, yes. and to use and to be active in that.
Yes. So don't forget about that. That's coming up next week. But until then, from the bridge
to the other bridge
to the island in between, this has been
Congratulations Pine Tree.